Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro-Libertate Radio, a full-throttle, no-holds-barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
I noticed that Sheriff Joe Arpaio of Maricopa County, Arizona, has got a 50-caliber machine gun, a belt-fed 50-caliber machine gun, which is a pretty neat little piece of heavy artillery. It shouldn't really be used for domestic law enforcement. That isn't to say, of course, that there is no proper domestic use for such an implement, given that I'm a Second Amendment maximalist. I subscribe to the view that anything that the government has, the people should have in larger quantity, given that the government, as our servant, should take orders from us and hence be afraid of us rather than the other way around. But Mr. Arpaio was transported out to a stretch of desert in Arizona yesterday to stage a photo op. They call this a crime suppression sweep. It's actually a cynical PR gambit. As a matter of fact, I think Joe Arpaio's public relations aide recently referred to him as a publicity whore. So henceforth, I'm going to refer to him as publicity whore Arpaio, given the fact that somebody on his payroll who's in charge of crafting his public image has copped to that description, which I think is a perfectly apt, albeit inadequate description. I refer to him as the Mussolini of Maricopa County, but publicity whore, I think, in this context is a suitable way to describe him. This is a public relations stunt, and of course, for those involved in this, it's overtime. This is from, I believe, the Arizona Republic. In a stretch of barren desert alongside Interstate 8 near Gila Bend that has become a corridor for human and drug smuggling, let me stop right there, we don't know if that's the truth. The only source that I have seen refer to that stretch of Arizona as a corridor for human and drug smuggling is the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office. That plus a reliable fact would give you one fact. I just don't believe anything that comes out of that office. Let's rewind a bit. In a stretch of barren desert alongside Interstate 8 near Gila Bend that has become, allegedly, a corridor for human and drug smuggling, Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio and about 100 men staged a crime suppression operation Thursday. Arpaio brought with him a belt-fed 50-caliber machine gun that can shoot accurately up to a mile as a display of the kind of force he would use if anyone hurts a deputy. Quote, "I am trying to send a message to Mexico," he said. "We will not take anyone hurting our deputies. We will fight back." Now, that's really interesting. Every once in a while, quite in spite of himself, Mr. Arpaio will tell the truth by way of what some people would call a Freudian slip, not being a believer in Freud. I think this falls under the category, once again, of the principle described in the New Testament. From the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So, speaking out of what in his case would serve as the rough analog of a heart, Mr. Arpaio here is correctly articulating the priorities of any government law enforcement agency. They are officer protection uber alla. The purpose of hauling this 50 caliber machine gun out into the desert was to provide some kind of a palpable illustration of the seriousness with which they take the mission of officer safety. Once again, this is what he said. "I am trying to send a message to Mexico. We will not take anyone hurting our deputies. We will fight back." The 7-year-old gun has not yet been used, Arpaio said. "It is more for defense." No, it's not. This is not a defensive weapon. "Nor have any of his deputies yet been harmed in a border scuffle. We have been very lucky," he said. No, you've not been lucky. It's just not that dangerous of a job. There was an incident several months ago in which a sheriff's deputy from another county in Arizona was allegedly involved in a shootout. The interesting thing about that shootout is that while everybody assumes that he was throwing lead in a confrontation with drug smugglers from Mexico, which is a possibility, there's plenty of that goes on. That, of course, is a reflection of the perfectly demented policy of drug prohibition, which is something that is directly responsible for most of the violence at the border and in Mexico. But the sheriff's deputy, before he had a chance to file a report, before anybody had a chance to examine the crime scene, and check out the validity of this story, this very dramatic story he told about being surrounded and outnumbered by people packing AK-47s. He lawyered up before he did anything else. And physical inspection of the crime scene here makes it look as if maybe a handful of rounds were sent his way. This wasn't a situation where he was being attacked by people carrying automatic or semi-automatic weapons. This looks like a shootout involving a group of people with handguns, because they were able to collect handgun rounds, spent handgun rounds from other firearms apart from the one that the sheriff's deputy was packing. I suspect that when we learn the truth about this, there's something in this sheriff's deputy's conduct that he's trying to hide, and perhaps you had a business dispute rather than a case of some fair and perfect knight in the service of the county sheriff's department coming under siege by heartless criminals from Mexico. In any case, let's continue with this story. The sheriff said criminals smuggling drugs and immigrants across the border are now carrying AK-47s along the swath of desert that is seldom patrolled, the Barry M. Goldwater Range. And I stop once again to offer this interlinear comment. It just strikes me as perverse that there is federal, quote-unquote federal land named after Barry Goldwater. It just seems to be so utterly ironic that somebody who is such an exponent of the state's rights view, as it's called, inaccurately, states don't have rights. They do in a federal republic have reserved powers. But somebody who is a proponent of federalism in which states have the predominant role and the federal government is the authorized agent of the states would have territory that the federal government holds illegally in defiance of the Constitution named after him. The Barry M. Goldwater Range is used for shooting and cannot be patrolled without permission from the United States Air Force. This gives smugglers, supposedly, an advantage here. In other words, if there's smuggling going on, these people are taking advantage of the federal government's unconstitutional adverse possession of territory in Arizona. Now, just in the last couple of weeks, we've heard a lot of people talk about the idea that there's this huge swath of Arizona, up to 80 miles or so, 80 square miles or so, that has been effectively surrendered to the possession of Mexican drug cartels. There's no evidence to support that proposition, apart from the fact that there are signs posted by federal agencies, I believe by the Forest Service, the parks in question are operated by the federal government, warning people to be aware of the fact that they might encounter people who are involved in some kind of illicit commerce, who are operating vehicles at unsafe speeds, and so be advised that you might run into somebody who's behaving irresponsibly. And this has been, how best to put this, this has been lacquered with alarmist rhetoric to the point where people are trying to say that Kenyan-born usurper in the White House, for whom, by the way, I bear no brief, in case you hadn't noticed that, I'm not a fan of Mr. Obama at all, that this Kenyan-born usurper in the White House has surrendered sacred sovereign American soil to these desperados from Mexico. It's not true. It's simply not true. There are terrible things that are going on in Arizona and elsewhere in the western United States as a result of federal intervention, unconstitutional federal intervention in the affairs of the states. But here you have an example where if some part of what we're being told about the problems with illegal immigration and drug smuggling, which are significant problems and threats to property rights, don't get me wrong on that point either. But to the extent that those problems are going on, these are problems that are working in synergy with the unconstitutional actions of the federal government, to which many people want to give more power in the name of protecting us from the problems that the federal government is either creating or exacerbating to begin with. And this is a splendid example of this. It's a splendid example of many things. I mean, it's, of course, a useful reminder of the fact that Mr. Arpaio is an incorrigible publicity whore, and Sheriff Babu, his neighbor, is pretty much following point by point Mr. Arpaio's playbook. They're both from Massachusetts. They both moved to Arizona in search of more congenial political climates. They're people who perceive their roles as county sheriffs as being primarily that of attracting publicity for their departments and for themselves personally. But these people, I think, are taking a problem that is in remission. We've got other problems that are eclipsing that of immigration right now. It's a problem, don't get me wrong. It's a problem that is abating. Immigration is down in Arizona over the last several years, down into the United States, both legal and illegal. That's because we've got a larger problem called the Depression. And people don't tend to migrate into depressed economies. The problem of violent crime in Arizona is down, but this is an election year, and it's an off-year election. And this is an issue that has been turned into a huge caricature of itself for cynical political purposes. People are trying to extract from this what political gain they can in order to propel the Republicans back into prominence in Congress. And trust me, the Republicans would be no better than the gang running things right now. Will Gregg, Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back at you in just a minute or two. Hope to hear from you. On the subject of what some people call blowback in the drug war, let me define that term quickly before we proceed. Blowback refers to the unintended but eminently predictable consequences of messing around in somebody else's country or staging an intelligence operation that tends to ricochet in a way that creates a bigger mess than you dealt with in the beginning. For an example of blowback, for probably the best example of blowback I can think of, you can talk about what's happened in Afghanistan. Way back in 1978, Zbigniew Brzezinski sidled up to Jimmy Carter and said, "Hey, Jimmy, I've got a great idea. Why don't we send the CIA into Afghanistan and start chumming the waters there with money and rile up a bunch of hardline fundamentalist Islamic clerics to recruit holy warriors to stage some kind of a religious uprising against the Soviet-dominated communist government of Afghanistan. And within a year or so, the Soviets will have to invade, and of course, Afghanistan is where you go if you want your empire to die. So why don't we arrange a nice little Vietnam scenario in Afghanistan by working with these elements to overthrow the government and then stage this long, drawn-out, bloody, enervating guerrilla conflict?" And Jimmy signed off on it. At least I'm assuming he signed off on it. Chances are he took orders from Zbigniew Brzezinski rather than the other way around. But in any case, that happened in 1978, and for almost 12 years, you had the Soviets being bled dry to the point where it literally precipitated the collapse of that government, which, of course, was not a bad thing. I'm for any government collapsing, quite frankly. What happened is you ended up with this very nasty situation post-war, where the same people who had been receiving money and materiel and Stinger shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles and were building a drug market here in the West, in the United States in particular, heroin market, they were left in power, and they didn't like us either, as we know. That's not to say necessarily that that's the gang that brought off 9/11. I'm pretty sure that the gang responsible for 9/11 ultimately is the gang that was responsible for messing up in Afghanistan. But that's a pretty good example of blowback. Well, here's another really good example with respect to the so-called war on drugs and the violence on the border. This is from the Washington Post. Today, headline, Mexican drug cartel's newest weapon, Cold War-era grenades made in U.S. Grenades made in the United States and sent to Central America during the Cold War have resurfaced as terrifying new weapons in almost weekly attacks by Mexican drug cartels. Sent a generation ago to battle communist revolutionaries in the jungles of Central America, stop right there. At least some of those communist revolutionaries were brought to power with the help of Washington. I'm thinking specifically of the people who were running Nicaragua. They came to power after they deposed the last U.S. elevated junta, that of Anastasio Somoza, who was a pretty thoroughgoing jerk, a pretty corrupt and brutal guy. He created a situation where he completely destroyed whatever political viability he had during an earthquake in the early 70s when he plundered, pilfered, he absconded with, he embezzled, however you want to describe this act of theft, a little bit too large a percentage of the international aid that was sent to help the victims of the Managua earthquake. I think that was in 74 or 75, one of the two. Might have been 73. As a matter of fact, I think it was 73. 73 or 74. If I remember correctly, and I probably don't, Roberto Clemente, may his soul rest in God's peace. He was a wonderful man, incredible athlete. I remember vividly seeing the news report about Roberto Clemente's plane going down when he was trying to deliver relief supplies to Nicaragua. His plane crashed because the cargo, if I remember correctly, had been stowed incorrectly, and it threw off the delicate balance of this cargo plane, this antiquated cargo plane, and so it crashed, I believe, in the Atlantic, off the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua, if I remember my geography correctly. Chances are I don't. But it was during that whole unfortunate period that Somoza, who'd been installed by United States Marines under FDR, Somoza made himself just a little bit too conspicuous in his corruption, and so he lost the favor of Washington, and through a long and drawn-out process of relatively subtle intelligence and diplomatic maneuverings, the Sandinistas were brought to power in Nicaragua, and gee, wasn't that a good idea? And of course, to fight those guys, the United States would skim, the United States government, I hasten to specify, would skim the scum off the top of the local ruling class in each of these countries, send them to the School of the Americas to teach them how to torture and brutalize people, then send weapons into the region supposedly to fight the communists. Now, those grenades and other pieces of small arms and small artillery are in the hands of the Mexican drug cartels, which is to say they're in the hands of the Mexican government. Set a generation ago to battle communist revolutionaries in the jungles of Central America, U.S. grenades are being diverted from dusty old armories and sold to criminal mafias, who are using them to destabilize the Mexican government and terrorize civilians, according to U.S. and Mexican law enforcement officials. The redeployment of, that's an interesting euphemism, of U.S.-made grenades by Mexican drug lords underscores the increasingly intertwined nature of the conflict, as President Felipe Calderon sends his soldiers out to confront gangs armed with a deadly combination of brand-new military-style assault rifles purchased in the United States and munitions left over from the Cold War. Grenades have killed a relatively small number of the 25,000 people who have died since Calderon launched his U.S.-backed offensive against the cartels. That's, I bet, a very accurate way of summarizing it. I think maybe a handful of people have been killed by grenade attacks. But the grenades pack a far greater psychological punch than the ubiquitous AK-47s and AR-15 rifles. They can overwhelm and intimidate outgun soldiers and police while reminding ordinary Mexicans that the country is literally at war. Now, this is another good example of blowback. Felipe Calderon, who came to power amid an orgy of voter fraud that made the situation in Florida in 2000 look like a very mild dispute at a bingo parlor, Calderon literally has created a full-scale civil war in Mexico at the behest of Washington and with the material and financial support of Washington. He's being touted as, I believe Obama called him, the Mexican Elliot Ness, which he considers to be a compliment. Now, Elliot Ness, as embodied by Kevin Costner in that 1987 film that was scripted by David Mamet, one of my favorite screenwrights and playwrights, that's an appealing character, but you have to bear in mind that that's a character who was enforcing what? He was enforcing prohibition. And if you remember the film being sort of a sepia-toned exercise in nostalgia for a period that didn't really exist that way, even if you take a look at the way that it worked in the film, when they started to put the screws to Capone in Chicago, things got worse. You had bombs going off in cafes and children being killed as collateral damage in that film. Well, take that and multiply it by the square root of infinity, and I think you've got a pretty good idea of what it's like in Mexico right now as the Calderon regime carries out a literal war that is tearing Mexico to shreds. And really, when you look at it, the cartels are sort of an alienated business partner with the Mexican government right now. You've got a turf war going on between two completely corrupt factions in Mexico that's killing tens of thousands of people in order to enforce a policy that is utterly demented and completely unconstitutional. And that's what's creating a lot of the border violence on the Mexican side of the border. Not much of it is seeping through, thank heaven, but that may change. And when it does change, if it does change, you're talking about blowback. There have been more than 72 grenade attacks in Mexico in the last year, including spectacular assaults on police convoys and public officials. Mexican forces have seized more than 5,800 live grenades since 2007. Well, there's your blowback, folks. It's Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in a minute. This is out of today's Wall Street Journal, and once again, it really had occurred to me this morning that I'd be talking at length this evening about blowback of the drug war, but it is such an immensely important issue in terms of how it's driving, in my opinion, a lot of bad policy decisions. And there's a certain, once again, to use that overworked term of art, synergy between the bad policy decisions that represent sort of the permanent interests of our rulers and the seasonal enthusiasms and cynical ploys used during off-year elections as a way of mobilizing certain constituencies with respect to immigration and border enforcement and things like that. But out of this morning's Wall Street Journal, there's a piece entitled Inside Mexico's Drug War, Americans Allege Abuse. Now, it's important to recognize that what we're talking about, the actions of the people, the reported actions of the people who reportedly abused these Americans, we're talking about a foreign government and the enforcement apparatus of that foreign government, yes, but this is something that represents a return on investment, I guess, from the people who steal our wealth through taxes and then lavish it on their minions and servitors abroad. The dateline is Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. Two Americans were driving back to El Paso, Texas last December after an afternoon across the border in Ciudad Juarez. By the way, that's not the sort of place I'd visit for a vacation. A few blocks from the border, they were surrounded by Mexican Army trucks and pulled from their Dodge Ram. Mexico's military says it found two suitcases full of marijuana in the cab of the pickup truck. Two soldiers later testified that they drove the two Americans to a military compound on the outskirts of town, questioned them briefly, then turned them over to civilian authorities. The Mexicans were charged with possession of marijuana with intent to sell. Those two men, Sean Huckabee, no relation I'm sure, 23 years old, and Carlos Quijas, 36, are being held in a Ciudad Juarez jail. They tell a different story about what happened that night. They say Mexican soldiers planted the marijuana in their truck. When they arrived at the military base, they say they were blindfolded, tied up, hit with rifle butts, shocked with electricity, and threatened with death. Mexico's military is leading President Felipe Calderón's war against the nation's drug cartels, and Ciudad Juarez has emerged as one of the bloodiest battlegrounds. That, by the way, is why I would avoid Ciudad Juarez. Nationwide, drug violence has claimed more than 25,000 lives since 2006, with government security forces accounting for an estimated 7% of the dead. In June alone, 103 police and soldiers were killed. As the death toll rises, however, so have complaints about the military's tactics in trying to break the drug cartel's stranglehold on Mexican society. Oh, boy. The cartels are not strangling Mexico's society. The government of that unfortunate misruled country is strangling that society. And the cartels, to the extent that they have the type of influence that leads to widespread acts of terror, is a partner with the government of Mexico. Indeed, you're dealing with a near-perfect identity between the cartels and the government, to the extent, once again, that you're talking about the type of atrocities that we're reading about in this account. The Human Rights Office of the state of Chihuahua, where Ciudad Juarez is located, is investigating some 465 cases of alleged abuse and torture of Mexican citizens by soldiers. Gustavo de la Rosa, the office's ombudsman in Ciudad Juarez, says he knows of about 70 cases, in which soldiers are alleged to have planted evidence, including some involving suitcases packed with marijuana. Allegations of mistreatment of suspects have caught the eye of the U.S. Senate committee that oversees financial aid to Mexico for its war on drugs. In an internal report, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee says it received allegations of serious human rights violations in Ciudad Juarez last year. The report cites an unidentified young man picked up in El Paso who said he was arrested by the Mexican military in Ciudad Juarez and beaten and shocked. The man said he was released after the military concluded he had no useful information about trafficking, the report says. It sounds a little like extraordinary rendition, quite frankly. Mr. Huckabee says he was subjected to similar tactics. I believe what was done to me was torture, he said in an interview. When I did not answer their questions, they shocked me with a wire that was in my hands. My whole body froze up. The pain went from bearable to a point where I couldn't even talk. Mexican prosecutors say the two men were caught red-handed. Two soldiers involved in the arrest testified at their trial that they counted 99 packages of marijuana in the suitcases weighing more than 100 pounds. Messrs. Huckabee and Quijas say they've never been involved with drugs and would never have tried to cross the border with two suitcases of marijuana. During their trial, they produced three witnesses who testified that they saw the soldiers put suitcases into Mr. Huckabee's truck. A verdict is expected this month. Each man faces up to 25 years in prison. Representatives of Mexico's military and of President Calderon turned down requests for interviews. In a written response to questions from the Wall Street Journal, the Army said it briefly took the Americans to the military compound, but didn't torture them. We categorically deny that soldiers use these methods and say their actions are in total adherence to the law, the statement said. That sounds like something the Bush regime would have said when defending what happens in black sites. It continues to happen under the Obama regime, of course. The Army previously had dismissed complaints of abuse as the work of people allied with drug traffickers who want to drive soldiers out of Ciudad Juarez. Oh, yes. They're hoping that the narco-terrorists will win. Many times they make human rights complaints because they want to limit our capacity for action and besmirch the institution, said Brigadier General Jesus Hernandez Perez, commander of the 4th Artillery Regiment, in an interview late last year. The Wall Street Journal interviewed nine residents of Ciudad Juarez, some of whom have been convicted of crimes, who said they were tortured by soldiers at the main army camp on the outskirts of the city. A 33-year-old forklift operator said he had a firearm pointed to his head and was told he would be killed during a 48-hour interrogation. Two brothers, ages 53 and 56, said the military put plastic bags over their heads, shocked them, and staged mock executions. Once again, in this I see sort of the family signature of the United States government and the sort of tactics that are taught at the School of the Americas. This is right out of the sort of stuff that the CIA was fomenting in El Salvador and Nicaragua back in the 1980s. As a matter of fact, at one point, you'll forgive me for another digression within a digression, at one point, the CIA, and this is something that was written about by Morton Kondracki at the New Republic back in the mid-1980s, Mr. Kondracki was a supporter of funding the Nicaraguan counter-revolutionary arm, or the army, the so-called Contras. He was on site at a training camp for the Nicaraguan rebels, and he was there with some people who were obviously with the CIA. They made themselves, once again, a rather prominent and obvious CIA contingent by virtue of very conspicuously refusing to answer questions about their involvement with the CIA and wearing mirrored sunglasses and the other habiliments of Hollywoodized intelligence work. But they were talking about bringing in people from the Galtieri government in Argentina. Charming, charming government that was, in every sense that one can imagine, a fascist government. They were, to a certain extent, descendant of the Perón regime, but bringing in the Argentines, that is to say those Argentines, not the victim Argentines, not the good guys, but bringing in the people who were experts in disappearing other people into Nicaragua to train the Contras. And now you've got pretty much the same kind of stuff going on with the U.S.-funded and U.S.-equipped military in Mexico as they fight the U.S.-funded and U.S.-equipped narcotics cartels. Let's see, a 25-year-old construction worker said soldiers used a taser to shock his testicles. A 54-year-old diabetic rancher said he was blindfolded, beaten, and shocked on his testicles, elbows, and hands. He showed a reporter the scars. I hope he didn't show all the scars to the reporter. By the way, doesn't this sound like the sort of stuff that's happening all the time here on our side of the border? There is literally not a 24 or 48-hour period that goes by without some perfectly outrageous story of police doing this same kind of thing in this country and getting away with it. And by getting away with it, I mean not being criminally prosecuted for it. There was a video that was making the rounds earlier this week of a 57-year-old school teacher in a southern state, I think it was Georgia, who made the mistake of calling the police because she was worried about somebody breaking into her home, and she ended up being tasered. It's like I say, if you want help, if you're facing some kind of a crisis, don't call the police. There are good police officers. There are conscientious people who carry out that function. But the odds are not good that you're going to be in contact with them. And the odds are becoming prohibitively in favor of receiving the unwanted attention of somebody who will taser you because you asked for help because you were worried that somebody was breaking into your home. Between 2006 and 2009, complaints to Mexico's National Human Rights Commission about the military grew tenfold to about 4,000, including allegations of robbery, rape, torture, and killing. The allegations threatened to undermine public support for President Calderon's military campaign against traffickers. Some 50,000 soldiers now patrol the country. In its statement, the military said it doesn't use torture under any circumstances. In Mexico, soldiers answer to their own military court system and not to civilian authorities, which means states can't prosecute them for abuse. Once again, the parallels are really quite interesting, aren't they? Oh, boy. This is Will Grigg with Pro Libertate Radio, 866-986-6397. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes, and I hope to hear from you. System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
Doubtless at least some of you have seen the film Animal House. And if you have, don't be ashamed to admit it. I saw it when I was a teenager, part of my wasted and misspent youth. There's a scene very early in that film. Of course, it's set at mythical, I believe it's called, Farber College. And I believe that the actual campus was in Portland. I think actually either Portland or Corvallis, Oregon, one of the two. But there was a scene where some hapless group of freshmen were being abused by upperclassmen. And these were pledges, these freshmen were pledges to the fraternity that lived at the titular Animal House. And as a couple of the fraternity leaders saw what was going on as these people were being humiliated, mistreated, and abused. One of them said to the other, "They can't treat our pledges that way," to which the other replied, "Yes, only we can treat our pledges that way." I was irresistibly reminded of that scene from Animal House reading this account of these Americans who were accused of drug smuggling in Mexico, then arrested by the army. They don't need no stinking badges. They're the Mexican army. And, of course, they run with the pack. They run with the cartels, one or the other of the cartels. And you read about these people being horribly abused in a foreign prison and being run through a so-called justice system, which is in some ways perhaps as bad as or maybe even a touch worse than the one afflicting our country. And I think that there's going to be sort of an Animal House fraternity leader conceit, a species of nationalism that's going to inform this discussion. And the upshot of it's going to be, no, that government can't abuse our citizens. Only our government can abuse our citizens. That's pretty much the sum and substance of this discussion, because nobody really wants to go any deeper into the issue and examine the ways in which the government ruling us is really responsible for both of those kinds of abuse. If we didn't have this perfectly deranged war on drugs to begin with, chances are, if these people had been involved in bringing marijuana across the border and marijuana was illegal in Mexico, chances are they could have given up la mordida, the little bite, the casual bribery that really is the lubricant of whatever commerce takes place in Mexico, and gotten through the border, and they could have brought that quantity into this country, and nobody would have been harmed. except perhaps the people who saw fit to consume that substance. I'm not an advocate of consuming marijuana, but that's your deal, not mine. Many people are not advocates of consuming soft drinks. I drink soft drinks. They are much more harmful to me, quite possibly, than marijuana. Certainly if they have high fructose corn syrup, which is a toxin that is richly subsidized by the United States government and in practically everything, we're far likelier to find ourselves dying as the result of congestive heart failure, arteriosclerosis, strokes, heart attacks, cancer, obesity-related problems that are a direct result of the government's subsidy of high fructose corn syrup. Now, I'm going to see if I can remember this story, and I'm probably going to do it violence because this is something that just occurred to me, but it's worthwhile to look into the history of Coca-Cola by way of illustrating how consummately hypocritical the whole war on drugs has become, how bad it has been from the beginning. Coca-Cola began as a drink that was a form of adulterated European wine, and it began as a hangover cure. It was an elixir that combined the derivatives from the coca leaf, from which it takes its name, Coca-Cola, with caffeine. So you had caffeine, and what is the derivative of coca? Yes, chocolate. What else? Cocaine. And cocaine, when mixed with caffeine in a palatable beverage, was used as a palliative for hangovers. This was devised by a druggist who supported prohibition. The really weird thing is that this druggist who devised Coca-Cola, and his name eludes my memory right now, was, as so many other veterans of the Civil War, what we're told to call the Civil War, he was a Confederate soldier, which means that at least he was fighting defensively and not offensively. So many other people involved in that conflict became drug addicts. He was, I believe, a morphine addict, and he ran a drugstore. It's a bad thing, a real, really dangerous occasion of sin and self-destruction. But it became a subject of some controversy, and the federal government moved to crack down on Coca-Cola as a dangerous substance. When the first Pure Food and Drug Act was passed, and if memory serves, 1903, this was used to target the Coca-Cola company, which ran fountains. They didn't bottle Coca-Cola back then. You'd go to a fountain. And in Atlanta, which was the place where Coca-Cola was devised and first unleashed on the market, Atlanta had fountains practically in every corner. You'd go into a store and you'd get it at a given mixture, a given ratio of soda water to the syrup. And one of the biggest mistakes that Coca-Cola ever made, by the way, was that they actually sold the patent on the formula, and that created a bunch of millionaires, and once the formula was sold, that was the end of the transaction as far as the selling party was concerned. But once they were able to franchise this and bottlers went into business as independent franchisers, they made a killing on it. But it was originally sold at fountains. But the federal government became concerned about the fact that there was a dangerous substance in Coca-Cola, and they wanted to bring Coca-Cola within the ambit of regulatory authority in the interests of public health and safety. Now, the dangerous substance, strangely enough, was not cocaine, which remained in the beverage at some level of concentration until 1929. Now, prohibition, of course, was in effect until the early 1930s. So during almost the entire run of prohibition, they were actually selling Coca-Cola as a healthy alternative to alcohol, and Coca-Cola had some concentration of cocaine in the formula until 1929. It was very, very diluted by that time, but the point is there was still cocaine in the beverage. There was enough cocaine in the beverage that possession of a cocaine cola of that sort today would be a felony. But in any case, in 1903, when the federal government cracked down on Coca-Cola, the dangerous substance wasn't cocaine, it was caffeine. Now, caffeine wasn't listed as a dangerous substance. And it can be a dangerous substance. There's a really interesting YouTube video of Dave Grohl. He's a drummer and also a guitar player for, most recently, the band Them Crooked Vultures, He is a caffeine addict. Self-described admitted caffeine addict. He will drink maybe 7 fresh pots of coffee a day. If you have time and interest, go to YouTube and just insert in the search engine the phrase fresh pots, and you'll probably be led immediately to one of 2 videos, one of which is a 2 or 3 minute video documentary showing Dave Grohl's coffee addiction, which actually led to hospitalization. He was suffering from tachycardia because he drank too much coffee, which is something very easy to do. That's something that was parodied, by the way, in the Will Ferrell film Kicking and Screaming. If you've ever seen that, if you haven't seen that, I'd recommend it. If you have seen it, you know what I'm talking about. But he literally had to be taken to the hospital because he was drinking too much coffee and cocaine in, or forgive me, cocaine. Cocaine in any quantity is going to have a bad effect on you, but caffeine in that quantity had a bad effect on him. And then there's another video of Dave Grohl simply looking in the general direction of the camera and yelling, "Fresh pots!" for 10 minutes. They have a film loop of him doing this. But that's what caffeine addiction can do. The federal government, in its benevolence, wanted to crack down on Coca-Cola because of the caffeine, not because of the cocaine. So the whole time of Prohibition, almost the entire period of time when our country was in the middle of this collective fit of derangement called alcohol prohibition, people were being urged to drink Coca-Cola with cocaine in it as a healthy alternative to wine or beer or spirits. At least in the earlier prohibition, and this is a point I made before and I will make again, in the earlier experiment in prohibition, the federal government and the people who promoted this realized that they had to change the Constitution because the federal government had no constitutional authority to be regulating the market for alcohol. So they changed the Constitution to give the federal government that authority. And then within a generation, they realized that they had done something spectacularly stupid, and they repudiated the prohibition of alcohol. They didn't stop regulating it, however. And by this time, they'd seized on this weird little plant associated with Mexican immigrant workers called marijuana as the next big demon substance. And we're still dealing now with prohibition a century later, and it's killing tens of thousands of people in Mexico. It's killing people here in the United States. It's destroying what remains of the Bill of Rights, and it's helping to create these immigration pressures on our border because people in border cities where there's a literal shooting war going on are trying to get across the border so they don't get killed. End drug prohibition, you know what? One of the major contributing factors to immigration pressures will be gone, too. That's it for the first hour of Pro Libertate Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes for hour 2. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.